Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram for Thursday, October 8th. Two Midland zip codes make list for most donations to Trump. The story was written by Stuart Doreen. Two Midland zip codes were among the top 15 in the nation in terms of donations to President Donald Trump, according to a report from the website Stacker. Stacker reports that 79705 and 79707 were 10th and 15th in the nation, respectively, in terms of donations to the Donald J. Trump for President Incorporated Campaign Committee. Stacker reports that it analyzed Federal Election Commission records from January 1, 2019 to July 31, 2020, to compile the list of 50 zip codes across the nation that have donated the most money to Trump over the past 2 years. Quote, only FEC processed records from unique individuals, as opposed to outside groups or committees, were considered, Stacker reported. Midland residents in zip code 79705 made 805 donations totaling $303,000 to the president. The zip code 79705 generally has Midkiff Road as its western boundary and Golf Course Road as its southern boundary. It covers most of the residences moving from central and north central to east northeast Midland and into the county. Of the zip code, Stacker wrote, quote, this particular part of Midland is racially diverse and mostly middle class. Historically, Midland tends to lean conservative, and the 79705 zip code is no exception, end quote. Midland residents in 79707 made 1,274 donations, totaling $265,000. The zip code 79707 generally has Midkiff Road as its eastern boundary and Golf Course Road and State Highway 191 as its southern boundary. It covers most of the residences moving west-northwest and into the county beyond State Highway 158. Of the zip code, Stacker wrote, quote, Midland leans to the conservative side when it comes to political parties and voting. During the last presidential election, the votes in Midland came in at 20% Democratic, with 75% voting Republican. The most donations from any zip code were $479,000 from zip codes 33480 Palm Beach, Florida. Second on the list was 77024 Houston with $20,000 donations. The next three zip codes were 90210 Beverly Hills, California, 75225 Dallas, and 78209 San Antonio. Zip codes in Texas made three of the top five and five of the top 10. Stacker reported that Texas donations to Trump's campaign totaled $29 million. Zip codes from Scottsdale, Arizona, The Villages, Florida, Newport Beach, California, Dallas, and Midland rounded out the top 10. A zip code from Odessa also made the top 50. Stacker reported 79765 was 44th, with 334 donations, totaling $170,000. The zip code includes East Odessa residences around Odessa Country Club and the Parks Legato Town Center. The zip code also includes areas of North Odessa inside Loop 338. Of the zip code, Stacker wrote, quote, the people in Odessa often vote Republican despite lower campaign donations to the Trump campaign. Presently, more than 120,000 people reside in Odessa. End quote. Because the list didn't represent donations to outside groups or committees, not included was the $7 million that reportedly was raised when the president made a campaign stop in Midland, Odessa in July. Stacker describes its website as, quote, combining objective expert analysis with rich editorial insights, delivering stories that help readers understand important topics in their neighborhood or around the world, and a format that's enjoyable to consume, end quote. MISD, cost of renaming Lee High School, could cost $3.4 million. The story was written by Stuart Doreen. Renaming Robert E. Lee High School and Robert E. Lee Freshman High School could cost as much as $3.4 million, according to a preliminary rebranding report compiled by the school district. The costs take into consideration the name change and the change in school colors. The cost of the name change only would be $1.7 million. Midland ISD reported from the beginning that costs would be announced before the board made a decision on the naming of the schools during the regularly scheduled meeting later this month, October 18th. The number one recommendation from the Citizens Renaming Committee is Legacy of Equality and Excellence High School. Tall City High School was the number two choice. The board also will make decisions on how to move forward with mascots and colors. The preliminary rebranding report shows costs broken down by facilities, fine arts, and athletics. Should there be changes to the name and school colors, the district reports $2.6 million in cost to facilities, $234,000 in fine arts costs, and $610,000 in cost to athletics. The largest cost would include $559,000 for contractors' project costs, $500,000 for signage, and $384,000 for changes to the gyms. Should just a name change take place, the costs are estimated at $1.1 million for facilities, $70,000 for fine arts, and $610,000 for athletics. In this scenario, signage would be $325,000, followed by $262,000 for contractors' project cost, and $258,000 for changes to the gyms. Changes to athletics are the same under either scenario, with football being the sport that carries the greatest costs, $249,000. Cheerleading, $41,000. Girls' soccer, $32,000, boys' soccer, $32,000, and cross-country, $29,000, rounded out the top five. The district reported that costs made to items donated by booster clubs are included. When the board originally brought up the renaming of Lee High School and the freshman school, Board President Rick Davis said there was the possibility of the cost being substantial. Quote, "We've also had people in the community volunteer to raise money to help defray the cost," Davis said in July, "and I believe that they will follow through on those efforts. How much of that cost will be defrayed or borne by those efforts remains to be seen until we know what the cost of those efforts are," end quote. Costs to facilities were determined by having multiple contractors provide estimations. Daryl Dodds, chief financial officer for the district, said the work included things from gym floors to branding in floor and wall tile to paint schemes across the campuses. Currently, Midland ISD has a fund balance close to $150 million, or 37 to 38% of the budget, according to Dodds. He said work already has started on the budget, and the preference will be to have it part of the regular budget process and not be dependent on going to the fund balance. He also said 80% of a typical budget is salaries, and it would be hard to predict what changes are in store for the district after the Texas legislature meets next year. Davis offered the following Wednesday about the potential renaming costs. Quote, "Any attempt to estimate the cost of a name change depends on a variety of factors, such as the name, mascot, and school colors, and no decisions have been made as to those matters," Davis wrote. "And even once those decisions have been made, I would not anticipate that all the ramifications of those decisions would be implemented immediately for various reasons." Continuing the quote, "For example, the timing of a bond designed to address our secondary facility needs would be one reason not to implement all changes immediately. If, for instance, a bond is proposed next November that proposes to relocate Lee High School to a new building and repurpose the existing campus, all the building and campus ramifications of this name change can be included on the new LHS campus with no additional cost, instead of making all of them on the existing campus. And even if such a bond does not occur or pass, some of the changes may need to be implemented over time for a variety of other reasons, including cost, and so patience will be required." Joyner outraises all other MISD candidates. The story was written by Stuart Doreen. Katie Joyner has outraised all other candidates running for Midland ISD School Board by more than a combined $10,000. The candidate for District 4, which encompasses some of Central Midland and works its way into Southwest Midland, reported raising $28,000 during the reporting period that ended in late September. The next closest candidate in any of the four races on the November 3rd ballot was Robert Marquez in District 2, South and Southeast Midland. He raised $9,000. The other seven candidates turning in reports, including Marquez, running in Districts 1, 2, 4, and 7, combined to raise just more than $18,000. With the exception of Marquez, no other candidate has raised more than Joyner has already spent, $6,600 on signs and consulting work. Monday was the deadline to turn in reports for the period that went through September 24th. Only one candidate, Joel Deal in District 3, failed to turn in a report. District 1. The two challengers to current board member James Fuller reported having raised more funds than the current dean of the school board. Michael Booker has raised $5,250, while Matt Galindo has raised $2,600, including $1,000 from former city council member Jose Cuevas. Donations to Booker included $500 from Norman Elite, the business whose ownership includes current councilman John Norman. Fuller reported having raised $1,000. Booker has spent $4,000, while Galindo showed $1,600 in expenditures. Fuller's spending was $908. Signs made up a majority of the spending for all three candidates. District 2. Marquez still had more campaign contributions maintained, $6,400, than Rachel Davis had contributions, $4,200, at the end of the period. He reported spending a similar amount on signs and radio, while Davis had not yet had any expenditures to report. District 4. Joyner's campaign contributions included checks of $250 or more from current or former elected officials, $500 from Midland College board member Linda Cowden, and the largest donation of the period, $2,500, from former Mayor Wes Perry. Her spending included $2,000 on consulting, and more than $4,000 on advertising with AdMark. Stevie Vargas reported raising $3,900, including $1,000 from Cuevas. District 7. Brian Murray, a current board member, reported raising $200. That was added to his previous campaign balance, $1,900. He has used that total for $986 on political signs. His opponent, Joseph Gallegos, reported not raising or spending any money. Man charged in death of infant. A Midland man was being held at Midland County Jail Wednesday on a capital charge in connection with the death of an infant, according to a press release from the city's spokeswoman. Bond had not been set for Cleveland C. Johnson II, age 33, as of Wednesday night, for the charge of capital murder of a person under 10 years of age. Midland police responded at about 12:30 a.m. Wednesday to Midland Memorial Hospital Emergency Department in reference to an infant death. Johnson brought the child to Midland Memorial Hospital late Tuesday night with respiratory and cardiac issues, according to the release. An investigation into the death revealed the infant suffered multiple broken bones and other injuries, according to the release. The investigation is continuing. MISD, student charged with making terroristic threats. Midland ISD confirmed Wednesday night that one student was arrested and charged with making terroristic threats at Goddard Junior High School. District police had received a Crime Stoppers tip Wednesday morning regarding a social media post that referenced a bomb threat at Goddard. The Midland Police Department bomb squad swept the building but did not find any evidence of a bomb, according to an email from a district spokesman. Students who had been relocated to Emerson Elementary during the situation were able to return to class.
Hello, this is Michael reading additional articles from the Thursday Midland Reporter Telegram. City reports 45 more coronavirus cases from staff reports. Midland County has 45 new confirmed cases of coronavirus, the Midland Health Department reported Wednesday. These cases bring the week's total to 137 and the pandemic total to 4,080. The city said these cases are reflective of lab results from Tuesday. There are 1,347 active cases, 43 more than Tuesday, and 2,430 recoveries, two more than Tuesday, according to the health department. Also, there have been 85 COVID-19-related deaths in Midland County. Abbott gives okay for bars to begin reopening, by Paul J. Weber, Associated Press, Austin. Republican Governor Greg Abbott on Wednesday allowed bars to begin reopening for the first time since June, ending a lockdown that began during a massive coronavirus outbreak that became one of the deadliest in the nation. However, the move doesn't allow Texas bars to fully reopen, nor everywhere. Dallas leaders quickly made clear they would still keep bars sidelined, pointing to recent upticks in cases and hospitalizations. And bars that are given local permission to open starting next week can only do so at 50% capacity. Texas this week surpassed 16,000 virus deaths and is closing in on 800,000 confirmed cases. New cases in Texas have dramatically fallen since summer, and the number of COVID-19 hospitalizations has leveled off around 3,200, three times lower than July's grim peak, but also a patient load that has stopped falling in the last 2 weeks. It is also roughly the same number of patients Texas reported in mid-June when cases began to skyrocket and Abbott retreated from one of America's most aggressive reopenings, shuttering bars for a second time. He later expressed regret over letting bars back in business so quickly. But Abbott said safety protocols and testing are now better, adding that Texas would have an additional 100,000 rapid result tests daily starting next week. He did not elaborate in an announcement that was not open to the press and was instead made in a recorded video posted to Facebook. Even with more schools returning to school and more gatherings like football games, Texans have shown that we can contain the spread of COVID, Abbott said in the video. Last month, Abbott began relaxing some coronavirus restrictions for the first time since a summer surge in cases hammered Texas, overwhelming hospitals in Houston and along the hard-hit border with Mexico. Other states are now seeing a resurgence in cases, including Wisconsin, where health officials announced Wednesday that a field hospital will open next week at the state fairgrounds near Milwaukee. Nationwide, about 30,000 coronavirus patients are hospitalized, according to the COVID Tracking Project. Abbott's handling of the pandemic has come under fire, not just from angry bar owners, but also the right wing of his own party. Conservative activists who have driven the Texas GOP's agenda for years have filed multiple lawsuits accusing Abbott of overreaching in his lockdown orders and issuing a statewide mask mandate. Abbott, who for months has rejected calls to give local officials the power to impose tougher COVID-19 restrictions, made bar reopenings conditional on the approval of county leaders. An industry group for Texas bar owners blasted the move, accusing Abbott of putting the tough decision on bar reopenings to counties. Construction complete on Permian Water Recycling Facility, by Aaron Douglas, Houston Chronicle. Houston-based Breakwater Energy Partners, LLC, says it has finished constructing the largest water recycling facility in the Permian Basin, following laws passed last year that sparked a rush on expanding the water recycling industry in West Texas. Last year, a Texas House bill and a New Mexico House bill were passed and determined that oil and gas operators own wastewater from hydraulic fracturing. They can sell that water to water recycling companies, who then take over the legal responsibility for the toxic brine. Those laws prompted some companies to bet that water recycling would emerge in the Permian as a big industry. Water recycling providers could provide oil and gas operators with a way to get rid of their responsibility to the wastewater, called produced water. Breakwater Energy's 80-acre facility between Howard and Martin counties can process up to 250,000 barrels per day of such produced water. The facility will help address a water recycling problem for oil and gas producers, said Jason Gennaro, the chief executive officer of Breakwater Energy Partners. It is difficult for producers to recycle 100% of the wastewater from hydraulic fracturing because they often lack the ability to aggregate enough recycled water when they need it, or they are unable to distribute their water to others when they have too much, he said. Collaborative recycling is the right thing for customers, Gennaro said in a statement. Operators don't want to pay twice for the same water, once for completions and a second time for disposal. Abbott joins opposition to nuclear waste project in New Mexico, by Adrian Hedden, Carlsbad Current Argus. Republican Texas Governor Greg Abbott was the latest public official to oppose a proposed nuclear storage facility to be built near Carlsbad and Hobbs, along with another in West Texas. In a September 30th letter to President Donald Trump, Abbott wrote that he worried locating high-level nuclear waste facilities in the Permian Basin region could put the U.S.'s most active oil and gas field at risk. Holtec International proposed building a consolidated interimis storage facility, CISF, to hold spent nuclear fuel rods temporarily in southeast New Mexico while a permanent repository, as required by federal law, was developed. Such a facility does not exist in the U.S. after a project to build one at Yucca Mountain, Nevada, was blocked by state lawmakers and defunded by former President Barack Obama. Another similar but smaller project was proposed by Interim Storage Partners, a joint venture between Orana USA and Waste Control Specialists, WCS, at a low-level waste facility owned by WCS and Andrews. Abbott pointed to about 250,000 active oil and gas wells on the Texas side of the Permian and another 40,000 in New Mexico. While the basin produced a record 1.5 billion barrels of oil in 2019 and 30% of all U.S. crude oil in 2018, and held 40% of the nation's proven oil reserves. All that could be at risk, Abbott said, if high-level nuclear waste was stored at the two locations. A stable oil and gas industry is essential to the economy and crucial to the security of our great nation, he wrote. Allowing interim storage of spent nuclear fuel and high-level nuclear waste at sites near the largest producing oil field in the world will compromise the safety of the region. The Federal Nuclear Regulatory Commission was tasked with evaluating applications for both Holtec and WCS facilities for 40-year licenses, and both companies expressed the desire to apply for future extensions. Both sites would hold the waste at the surface after it was shipped in via rail from generator sites across the country. Congress was required to develop a permanent solution to the nation's nuclear waste, Abbott said, but had not since the Nuclear Waste Policy Act was passed in 1982. The proposed facilities failed to provide the storage and disposal capabilities needed to properly manage the waste, he wrote. The proposed sites in Texas and New Mexico do not provide the deep geologic isolation required for permanent storage in order to minimize the risks of accidents, terrorism, or sabotage, which could disrupt the country's energy supply with catastrophic effects on the American economy, Abbott wrote to the president. Because of the many risks associated with these projects, the lack of a permanent facility, and the importance of the Permian Basin to the economy and energy security of our country, I respectfully urge you to join me in opposing the siting on an interim storage facility in Texas or in New Mexico. Abbott previously voiced concerns about the project in an April 2019 letter to the NRC and the U.S. Department of Energy, contending it would add the increased risk of high-level waste to states that already store low-level waste. New Mexico Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham also voiced opposition by repeatedly writing letters to federal officials since taking office in 2019. She called the project economic malpractice for the risks Lujan Grisham said it posed to the oil and gas and agriculture industries. Her approval of the proposal was joined by the state's top land manager, Stephanie Garcia Richards, the New Mexico Commissioner of Public Lands. In a September 22nd letter to the NRC, Garcia Richard said that despite the commission's recently issued Draft Environmental Impact Statement, DEIS, that found minimal environmental harm would be caused by the construction and operation of the site, she continued to have concerns about how the facility could affect drilling operations and groundwater supplies. Garcia Richard also said the facility could become the de facto permanent repository for high-level nuclear fuel because of the planned license extensions and a lack of an expressed permanent resting place for the waste. She said the state land office controls the mineral estate beneath the surface at the proposed location for the Holtec site and could not place restrictions on oil and gas operations in the area to ensure the proposed facility was not disturbed by such operations. Holtec's proposed project is problematic for many reasons. The intended site is located in the middle of the Permian Basin, one of the world's most productive oil and gas regions, Garcia Richard wrote. Any production decline related to a work stoppage could be hugely detrimental to the state's finances, which is heavily dependent on oil and gas taxes and revenues, as well as local economies. The project also saw opposition from oil and gas companies themselves. In June 2019, Concho Resources and EOG Resources both sent letters to the state land office citing concerns of the nuclear facility's impact on fossil fuel development in the region. Christopher Boyler, director of the Government and Regulatory Affairs for Concho, said Holtec had not adequately studied potential impacts on oil and gas. He said the company had a lease with the land office for minerals beneath the proposed Holtec site and could not support the project until it was assured there would be no risk to its operations or that of the industry in the Permian Basin. Until and unless Holtec conducts scientific studies and provides data supporting its proposed use of the subsurface without negative impact to Concho's current and future operations underneath its oil and gas lease, Concho is unable to support Holtec's proposal, Bowler said. No operation is risk-free, and certainly not any operations handling nuclear waste, he said. Midland Reporter Telegram opinion page, Thursday, October 8th, 2020. Opinion extra. If Trump loses this election, it's on him. Joe Biden is a terrible candidate. He is 77 years old. He is incoherent. He has called a lid every other day of his campaign to avoid serious questioning. His running mate, Senator Kamala Harris, is so unpopular that she dropped out of the Democratic primaries before they even reached her home state. The Biden-Harris campaign is absolutely lackluster. And according to national polling, Joe Biden is leading incumbent President Donald Trump by up to 16 points. In the Real Clear Politics polling average, Trump is trailing Biden in every single swing state. Were the election held today, by the Real Clear Politics statistics, Biden would win 375 electoral votes, picking up states including North Carolina, Georgia, Virginia, Arizona, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. How is this happening? How did a doddering fool, a career politician mostly famous for his incurable LaGoria, end up in the catbird seat 1 month before the 2020 election? The answer is simple. Joe Biden understands the nature of this election. Donald Trump simply does not. To understand this election does not require a graduate course in political science. If the election is a referendum on President Trump, he will lose. If the election is a referendum on Joe Biden, he will lose. Trump is personally unpopular by every poll metric, and he has been consistently unpopular for years. But he was still able to win in 2016 because Hillary Clinton was even less popular. The same could have been held true here. After all, Biden has opened himself wide to serious questioning. He has repeatedly refused to state whether he is in favor of ending the Senate filibuster, adding new states, and packing the Supreme Court, calling such questions distractions. He has refused to condemn the Antifa movement. He has soft-pedaled Black Lives Matter violence in America's major cities. He has put forward the most left-wing platform in American history, according to communist fellow traveler Bernie Sanders. But Biden hasn't answered a single serious question. He has been able to avoid nearly all questions by pointing at his opponent. Biden hasn't just run a lackluster campaign. He hasn't run any campaign. He hasn't even walked a campaign. He has essentially grown into his couch in his Delaware basement, getting out only long enough to stand in front of an empty field or answer a few softball questions from a friendly pseudo-journalist. That's not just because the media hate Trump and sycophantically massage Biden, though they do. It's because Trump himself steadfastly refuses to recognize the central issue of the campaign, his own centrality. Trump loves being the center of attention, and he simply refuses to cede the spotlight. Every day is a new spectacle in Trump land, from descending in Marine One onto the White House lawn amid dramatic music to re-enter quarantine, to tweeting incessantly about the latest news of the day. The media hang on Trump's every word, and he appears to love that. But that symbiotic relationship between Trump and the media puts Trump at a dramatic disadvantage. The more people think about Trump, the less they want to. In 2016, the Access Hollywood tape unintentionally relegated Trump to the sidelines in the last days of the campaign, freeing the way for then FBI Director James Comey to put the spotlight squarely on Hillary Clinton's emails, and Trump won. In 2018, Democrats seized the spotlight by unjustly and cruelly maligning Justice Brett Kavanaugh, and the polls consequently tightened. Then Trump seized the spotlight back by talking about illegal immigration caravans, and Democrats won. Joe Biden has learned the lesson. Biden has spent this campaign pointing at Trump. Trump, who should be pointing at Biden, is too busy pointing at himself. Unless Trump somehow suppresses his ego enough to allow Biden to become the issue, Trump is likely to exit the political stage altogether come November 3rd. Ben Shapiro, Creators Syndicate. Virus diagnosis gives Trump last chance to reset campaign. President Donald Trump's COVID-19 diagnosis is a blessing in disguise because it has given him one last chance to win over millions of reluctant voters who approve of his policies, but not of him. His illness has created a moment of sympathy, and with it, an unexpected opportunity for a reset. He needs to seize that moment by offering the American people a clear vision for how he will end this pandemic. He may not take this advice, but whether he does may well determine whether Americans give him a second term. As soon as his health permits, the president should deliver an address to the nation on his recovery and the way forward in the battle against the virus. He should begin by thanking Joe Biden for his graciousness during this difficult moment and talk about how moved he was by the prayers of millions of Americans, including many who do not support him, for his and the First Lady's recovery. He should discuss his experience fighting COVID-19 in deeply personal terms and express his empathy and solidarity with the millions of Americans who have struggled with it. He should say that just as he beat the virus, so will America, and then lay out his vision for how we will do so. Rather than relitigate the past, he should offer a hopeful vision for the future by focusing on the one initiative that will allow us to defeat COVID-19 once and for all, Operation Warp Speed. Trump can remind Americans that in May he launched a massive scientific, industrial, and logistical endeavor unlike anything our country has seen since the Manhattan Project, marshaling the resources of private industry, our public health agencies, and the Defense Department to speed the development, manufacture, and distribution of vaccines and therapeutics for the novel coronavirus and COVID-19. He should say that when he launched this initiative, he had no idea it would one day help save his own life. When he became sick, doctors gave him one of the therapeutics developed under Operation Warp Speed, an experimental antibody drug created by Regeneron Pharmaceuticals that infuses lab-generated antibodies into the body to boost the body's immune defense rather than waiting for it to muster its own. Without it, he may have suffered a far more serious illness. In July, his administration announced a $450 million project under Operation Warp Speed to scale up manufacturing of Regeneron's drug so that we have as many as 300,000 treatment doses available as soon as it is approved by the Food and Drug Administration. And this is just one example of how his administration is speeding development of therapeutics and vaccines that will speed our nation's recovery. Since May, the federal government has invested about $10 billion in 8 vaccine candidates, several of which are on track to complete Phase 3 trials by the end of the year or early 2021. Vaccines almost always take at least 5 years to develop. Operation Warp Speed will have done it in a matter of months. Trump should say that he understands some have questions about the safety of vaccines and therapeutics being developed under Operation Warp Speed, but that he can offer no better proof of their safety than taking them himself. He should say he took Regeneron's experimental treatment and will do the same when the first vaccine becomes available. He should then pivot to the progress we have made on the economy. In the past 4 months, we have added more than 11 million jobs, and third quarter economic growth is likely to break all previous records. The United States, he should say, is ready to get back to normal, and that return to normal is now within our reach. The day is coming, sooner than most imagine, when we will be able to hug our grandparents again, go back to work and school, and return to our previous lives. He has a clear plan to get us to that day. He should then take this message into the next debate. He should thank Biden for his prayers and not interrupt, mock, or belittle his opponent. Let Biden be the first to attack. He will say that it should not have taken the president getting sick for him to take the virus seriously. Trump should answer calmly that he has taken it seriously, as evidenced by Operation Warp Speed, but that now he understands the virus in a way no one who has not gone through it ever can. In the wake of his illness, Trump's devoted base will rally around him, but if he handles it right, the rest of the country could rally behind him too. Opinion column by Mark Thiessen, Washington Post Writers Group. COVID-19 is making a statement. I'm not vice president, It's not my responsibility to inquire daily about the health of the president. As a professional storyteller, I just came here to collect the yarn. And if what you hunger for is poetic justice, the apocalyptic year of 2020 is dope. What could be more poetic or more just than for the virus to afflict someone who has, over the last 7 months, mocked those who wear masks as weak or paranoid, dismissed the pandemic as a hoax, and the virus as no worse than the flu, promised it would someday magically disappear, pushed businesses to reopen too soon, and encouraged public uprisings against authority by freedom-loving zealots in states like Michigan? Worst of all, what did you think the universe had in store for a leader who has displayed such a breathtaking lack of empathy for more than 7 million Americans infected by the virus and the estimated 210,000 who died? It's only October, but the search is over for Time Magazine's Person of the Year 2020. The hands-down winner is Karma. The narcissist-in-chief only cares about himself, and his pathetic response to the coronavirus over the last several months proved that once again. It's no wonder that even before President Donald Trump tested positive for COVID-19 last week, polls showed that the vast majority of the American people considered him to be no match for the virus. According to a poll by CBS News, taken before Trump checked into Walter Reed National Military Medical Center, only 38% of Americans trusted him to do a better job of battling the disease, while 52% thought former Vice President Joe Biden would do better. The Beltway media has moved ahead. Now that Trump is out of the hospital and physician to the president Sean Conley is painting a rosy picture of his recovery, the media wants to know about the timeline and whether Trump acted recklessly in spreading the virus. Reporters want to know if Conley is telling us the full story about when Trump first displayed symptoms and about the severity of his case. They're also questioning whether Trump should have returned to the White House so soon and who else he may have infected before he checked into the hospital. All good questions. But from my vantage point, there are still things that need to be said about the fact that Trump was infected at all. Like the fact that COVID-19 is obviously making a statement. It's not going to let itself be ignored in this election year. Over the last few months, American voters and candidates for office have tried to shift their gaze away from what should have always been the number one issue on the ballot, the global pandemic. In fact, they've been eager to make this election about anything but COVID-19. They've wanted to focus on forest fires and climate change, police violence and social unrest, racial justice and maintaining order, or jobs and the economic recovery. Both political parties are playing this game of dodgeball. After the first debate, all Republicans wanted to talk about was what seemed to be Biden's lack of cognitive focus, as evidenced by how easily he got distracted. Meanwhile, Democrats tried to shift attention to Trump's irritatingly boorish behavior, as evidenced by his many interruptions and snarky jabs. Takeaways: Biden is not sharp, and Trump is an insufferable jerk. Choose. The biggest splash that COVID-19 made at the debate was when Trump tried to ridicule Biden for being cautious and usually wearing a mask. The president obviously thought that was silly. Who looks silly now? COVID-19 isn't back, folks. It never left. Finally, as a Mexican-American whose grandfather was not a rapist, criminal, or drug trafficker, despite what Trump might have you believe, I insist on gloating. If you're looking for compassion, sympathy, or even good manners, look elsewhere. With more than a dozen cases of COVID-19 among White House aides, Republicans who visited the White House, and various Trump associates, we need to build a wall around 16 Pennsylvania Avenue. Trump World is a germ colony. Consider me a bad person, if you like. After all, as conservative pro-Trump Republicans taught us over the last 4 years, being labeled a bad person is no big deal and not worth caring about. So put me down as not caring. Like I said, I'm just here for the story. And whenever a bully gets what's coming to him, it makes a good one. Opinion column by Ruben Navarrete, Washington Post Writers Group.
Here are some obituaries that appeared in the Midland Reporter-Telegram on Thursday, October 8th. Colonel Andre Catania retired. Army officer passed away at his home on September 14th. He was preceded in death by his wife, Jackie. He is survived by his two sons and their wives, Andrea and Richard Catania, Sylvia and Bertrand Catania, and three grandchildren. Donations in his memory can be made to the Wounded Warrior Project, Post Office Box 758516, Topeka, Kansas, 66673. Juanita Ann Barkley Tucker, age 93, passed away on October 6th. She was welcomed into this world by her loving parents, Robert Joseph Barkley Sr., and Sophronia Ann Rogers Barkley, on March 24, 1927, in McCulloch County, Texas. She graduated in May 1944 from Rochelle High School. She met and married Roy E. Tucker on August 5, 1946, at Sacred Heart Catholic Church in Coleman, Texas. They moved to Midland, Texas in 1950. She worked for the Midland Police Department for 32 years, from 1960 until her retirement in 1992. Juanita was preceded in death by her parents, Robert and Sophronia Ann Barkley, her husband, Roy E. Tucker, her son and daughter-in-law, Paul and Shirley Tucker, grandson, Kevin Dietrich, son-in-law, Raymond A. Meek, sister and brother-in-law, Lucille and Lewis Miller, sister and brother-in-law, Weda and Clayton Larimore, sister and brother-in-law, Wilma and Amos Regan, and her brother, Robert J. Barkley, Jr. She is survived by her children, Terry and Walt Dietrich of Midland, Jim and Sandy Tucker of Midland, Mary and Tommy Curray of Coleman, Liz and Carl Mitten of Granbury, Texas, Steve and Teresa Tucker of Anson, Texas, Tom Tucker of Coleman, and Stephana and Mark Sanderson of Talpa, Texas. She is also survived by her sisters, Violet Monroe of Doylestown, Pennsylvania, and Claudine Brown of Rainier, Oregon, as well as numerous grandchildren, great-grandchildren, great-great-grandchildren, nieces, and nephews. A rosary service was held on Tuesday, October 6, with Mass of Christian burial following at 2:30 p.m. and burial following at Santa Ana Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, please donate to St. Mary's Star of Sea Catholic Church in Ballinger, Texas, or a charity of your choice. Teresa Terry Cruz Robertson passed away peacefully in Lubbock on Saturday, October 3rd, at the age of 86. Terry is survived by her daughters Regina Neal of Brownfield, Texas, and Rita Duncan of Stanton, two brothers, two sisters. She is also survived by her grandchildren. She is blessed with numerous great-grandchildren and great-great-grandchildren. She is preceded in death by her husband, Donald G. Robertson, son, Max Cruz, parents, Cleto and Geneva Contreras Cruz, brother, Joe Cruz, sisters, Ramona and Judy Cruz. In lieu of flowers, please make donations to the ASPCA. Her dogs, Chula and Sister, were the lights of her life. Rosa R. Vila passed away Tuesday, October 6th. Visitation will be held Thursday, October 8th from 1 p.m. until 9 p.m. A rosary will be recited at 7 p.m. at Stanton Memorial Funeral Home. Funeral Mass will be held Friday, October 9th at 10 a.m. at St. Joseph Catholic Church. Interment will follow at St. Joseph Catholic Cemetery. Survivors include her daughters, Cynthia Lerma, Diane Vila, sons, Steve Lerma, Joey Vila. Funeral services are restricted to immediate family only. Funeral arrangements are entrusted to Stanton Memorial Funeral Home.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Odessa American for Thursday, October 8th, 2020, front page. Remember their names. Memorial Fundraiser begins. Month-long event will focus on donations, T-shirt purchases. United Supermarket employees wear T-shirts that can be purchased to help raise funds for the August 31st mass shooting memorial as they listen in on the press conference at Market Street Wednesday morning. T-shirts can be purchased for $15 until October 27th. Ben Powell, Odessa American. By Royal McGregor, RMCGREGOR at OAOA.com. United Supermarkets Regional Vice President John Jamison announced that United Supermarkets on Market Street will begin a month-long fundraising event that will benefit the Odessa August 31st Memorial. The announcement was made Wednesday morning during an in-person event that took place at the Market Street located at 4950 East 42nd Street. Jamison said the six United Supermarket and Market Street locations in Odessa and Midland will participate in this fundraising event. The fundraiser began Wednesday and will continue until October 27th. We want to do something that has a lasting impact on our community, Jamison said during the event. We are going to start an aggressive campaign that will kick off Wednesday. Our checkers will be talking up the memorial and pushing it really hard. Jamison also detailed that people can make any monetary donations to a cashier at the grocery store. He said people can also purchase T-shirts, which show a rendition of that August 31st memorial, for $15. Jamison said 100% of the T-shirt profits will go to the fundraiser. We'd love to raise $60,000 to $70,000, Jamison said. I really think with something like this, the sky is the limit. People are passionate about this. I think we'll be very successful. Prior to the beginning of the fundraiser, United Supermarkets and Market Street donated $10,000 to the fund for the August 31st memorial. Odessa Arts Executive Director Randy Hamm said the total cost of the memorial will be about $700,000. That includes renovations to Memorial Gardens, which is where the memorial will be placed, and for the artwork called Bright Stars, a memorial that will be created by Maryland sculptor Jim Sanborn. Hamm said $110,000 has been raised thus far. That includes $100,000 that came from hotel occupancy tax money and $10,000 that came from the initial donation of United Supermarkets and Market Street. He said that Odessa Arts applied for $200,000 in grants. We really want to have this finished by the second anniversary, Hamm said about the memorial. Anybody that wants to make a donation, come to United, do your grocery shopping like you would normally. Give us that $5 or $10 extra. That's really going to help raise the money for this. In attendance, there were more than 20 people who were all wearing masks. The kickoff took place at the dining area near the Starbucks. Odessa City Council members Dewey Bryant, District 2, and Mary Willis, District 5, were in attendance for the fundraiser kickoff. Bryant spoke during the event, and he hopes that the memorial can be a step forward in the healing process. Let this be the starting place for what we have to do to move forward, Bryant said. Let's use this as the nucleus for our community of Odessa. The memorial will remember the 7 people killed and 25 others injured during a shooting rampage in August of 2019 around Odessa and some parts of I-20. Odessa Arts Executive Director Randy Hamm takes a moment to thank city officials for their support of a memorial to commemorate those killed and injured during the mass shooting that took place in Odessa on August 31st. Ben Powell, Odessa American. United Supermarkets and Market Street, marketstreetunited.com. Mass shooting gun seller pleads guilty. Private gun dealer faces up to 5 years in prison. The Associated Press, Lubbock. Sisters of Odessa mass shooting victim Joe Griffith, Carla Byrne Center, and Marcy Askins Wright speak about their brother during a press conference at the Ector County Courthouse in August. The families of Joe Griffith and fellow victim Leila Hernandez filed a civil lawsuit against the private gun dealer Marcus Brazil and Anderson Manufacturing. Eli Hartman, Odessa American. The man who sold an AR-15-style rifle used in last year's mass shooting that killed 7 people in Odessa pleaded guilty Wednesday to unlicensed firearms dealing. Marcus Anthony Brazil, 45, of Lubbock, also pleaded guilty to concealing the proceeds from weapons sales from the IRS, according to a statement from federal prosecutors. He faces up to 5 years in federal prison. No sentencing date has been set. Brazil admitted selling the rifle that Seth Aaron Attar, 36, of Odessa, used when he killed 7 people and wounded 25 others in the Midland-Odessa area. The rampage ended when police shot Attar dead. According to court documents, Brazil admitted selling Attar an AR-15-style rifle on October 8, 2016, nearly 3 years before the August 31, 2019 shooting rampage. Documents said Attar, who had been adjudicated mentally defective and was therefore legally prohibited from possessing firearms, first attempted to purchase a gun from a sporting goods store, but was rejected after his mental status was flagged in the national database. He circumvented that system by buying a gun from Brazil, who did not run background checks on any of his buyers. Although background checks are not required for in-state private gun sales, Brazil admitted he was engaged in the business of selling firearms and should have been licensed and checking his clients' backgrounds. He admitted routinely buying firing mechanisms, using milling equipment to build them into guns, then selling them for profits of $100 to $200. In a 4-year span, Brazil inadvertently sold firearms to 4 people who were barred from having guns: a convicted felon, a man under felony indictment, an immigrant in the U.S. illegally, and Attar.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.